The Waltz of the Automatons in Leo Delibes' 1867 ballet Coppelia takes its cue from a story by E.T.A. Hoffman that has to do with mechanical women and is just one of the many manifestations of the machine imagery that seeped into 19th century literature and culture, imagery that remains with us today. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Year.
The Industrial Revolution brought tremendous changes to life in 19th century England, and America for that matter. But in the literature of the time, does the relationship between humans and machines come across as something positive or negative? How did mankind's relationship with machines redefine what it means to be human? And how did the literary response to machines change as the Industrial Revolution progressed? Our guest is Tamara Katabjian, chair of English at Beloit College, and author of The Lives of Machines, The Industrial Imaginary in Victorian Literature and Culture, published in 2011 by the University of Michigan Press.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
Your title, The Lives of Machines, seems a bit ironic because we think of machines as obviously dead and everything that's sort of an antithesis to life. Tell us why The Lives of Machines in your title.
Well, there are a number of reasons, but primarily I wanted to give people a different sense of, what was happening in the Victorian period. I think that, we have accepted a historical account of machines as dead and as alienating and as, antithetical to humanness. But actually, people were imagining machines as very much alive, as running on energy that was, organic, that, was the same kind of energy that human bodies and animal bodies ran on, and machines also that were incredibly sort of vital and vibrant because they were power machines. They were not simply clockwork, but they were run by coal. They were more vibrant and really sort of virile than ever before.
Well, the first name that comes to mind if I think of a Victorian writer who put a lot of machine imagery in his work would be Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
But I mostly can think of the negative side, machines as things that are life killers.
Right. But I think that, we have been really influenced by two powerful critics of machinery in the Victorian period, John Ruskin and Matthew Arnold. And Matthew Arnold, who wrote his, famous essay, collection of essays about culture, Culture and Anarchy in, 1869. He talks about high art culture, really, sort of seeking to, work against the, machinery that was prevalent during this period. That's really only one side of the culture, at this time. You have an incredible amount of, sort of enthusiasm that was occurring. And also, you have a kind of response to these different forms of, industrial technology, different kinds of factories, different kinds of, power machines, feedback, mechanisms and governors that really influenced the way that people think about psychology. So you have in a lot of novels and a lot of writing an account of feeling that is based upon, an understanding of pressure, people feeling under pressure. Dickens loves this metaphor, seeking a vent. It's not necessarily
that
you're always getting a, literal account of machines in fiction. I mean, sometimes you do. There are certainly, industrial novels of Britain in the 1840s and 50s, which did this, of which Dickens' Hard Times is a good example. But you have this whole kind of, metaphorical, imaginary world of machinery that people identified with, in their hearts. It's being, represented in fiction. And also, not only simply in terms of individual psychology, but also in terms of, communities of feeling, various ways in which people imagine spiritual sympathy telepathy as being like a kind of energy network that was akin to a factory. That's another way in which they imagine themselves as very mechanical. And we tend to forget this because we hear about the, to quote Blake, sort of the dark satanic mills.
Right.
You hear about the, degrading, alienating aspects of machinery. But there's an essay by Thomas Carlyle, eminent, Victorian sage and essayist, 1829, Signs of the Times, which has been interpreted as him talking about how machinery and, kind of bureaucracy in general, imagine as machinery, is mm-hmm. impoverishing, humanness and sort of, deadening us. But if you actually look at the essay, he says, man is grown mechanical in head and heart as in hand. I think I'm quoting him correctly. Maybe it's a little bit off here. And he's not saying that emotion has died. He's saying this is a new kind of emotion, this is a more intense, mechanical kind of feeling that's going on for good and for ill. I mean, I don't want to, overlook the, incredibly kind of, traumatic aspects of this development as well.
So before we get further into Dickens, I'm particularly mm-hmm. interested in locomotives.
Yeah.
You've mentioned Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold, when he talks about the relationship between machines and culture, he's saying that the culture is something that needs to be defended, or does he have a more positive attitude? And you mentioned also John Ruskin.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't talk about Arnold that much, actually, in this book, because I feel like, he and Ruskin have been treated a great deal. But, what I do mention is that, he talks about how culture should be apart from this mechanical world, right?
There seems to be a big strain of nostalgia running through a lot of Victorian novels, looking back at an era before the Industrial Revolution, before factories. You mentioned Charles Dickens' Hard Times, which is dedicated to Carlyle.
Right.
Let me just read from the keynote chapter, chapter 5, where it describes this fictitious city of Coketown, and have you comment about how you would interpret that in terms of this kind of study of machines. He writes about Coketown, and this is, a novel that talks about Mr. Thomas Gradgrind, obviously a name suggesting kind of something getting crunched. It was a town of red brick, or of brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves forever and ever and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye and vast piles of building full of windows where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness.
Yeah, that is... the keynote passage of Hard Times, and it's repeated perpetually. And it sounds so awful and oppressive and monotonous and represents all the ills that we associate with industrialism, right? That kind of alienation, this sense of grinding, indeed Gradgrind, although he's actually the school teacher, not the mm-hmm. industrialist, but mind. That's just horrible kind of sameness that happens with industrial regularity. Now, my point is that there's also something very emotional about this that we might overlook, that after all, this machine, it isn't simply a dead thing, to get back to the liveliness of machines, right? It's compared to an animal. It's compared to a living thing. Actually, the whole passage has a lot of kind of jungle imagery in it. It's compared to an elephant also that's a very emotional elephant, if you will, an elephant in a state of melancholy madness.
And you mentioned in your book that there might be a link to colonialism with the elephants from India, which I had not not thought of.
Yeah. If you trace some of the origins of some of this imagery, you can see that, well, there are two places to go with this. There is the colonial imagery, where Dickens is very influenced by articles that he himself published as an editor of the journal Household Words. These articles were about, you know, elephants that were very disruptive in India, and who in some ways became figures for Asian colonials and, you know, empire, and the possibility that beneath this kind of inscrutable monotony, there's a possibility for revolt. So there's that. And then there was also this famous elephant that Dickens himself visited in London. Chunee was his name, at the Exeter Change Royal Menagerie. And this elephant was, you know, just this perennial figure. Dickens writes of his attachment to this elephant in Sketches by Boz. But this elephant then, you know, suddenly went mad and had to be killed. And this was, you know, of course, great trauma for everyone. But my point here is that Dickens is really interested in this sense of very expressive and threatening mechanical regularity and monotony, that you can't really just take this at face level, but in fact, there's a sort of intensity to it that's charged, that causes us to reconsider, this kind of obedience, or, you know, even servility, you know, both in machines and in people. And so there's a way in which, you know, looking at these machines that seem kind of, you know, charged in various ways, also provides us with a way of understanding humans, human psychology, or I shouldn't even say offers us a way to understand, but also kind of offers a screen for projecting certain kinds of fantasies or fears.
Is it fairly common in this Victorian imagery to compare machines to animals? I mean, I think an earlier time, of course, of Blake's tiger, which becomes this kind of mechanic, organic entity.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is following a long, tradition of thinking about life and, you know, 17th, 18th century, you know, mechanistic philosophy, you know, clockwork life. But it's different because you have physiologists who are really thinking about, you know, vital force and energy. And you have also, especially after the 1850s, you know, people who are thinking about thermodynamics in really different ways. But so Victorians were talking about what they called an animal machine, right? And also, I mean, just in terms of, metaphors and figures, you so often have, animals and humans being compared to, in terms of their instinctive workings. This is both a medical trend, you know, theories of reflex action,
sure.
Marshall Hall and
sort
Samuel
of like pure,
Rehock.
Pure physics involved, with whether it's a machine or an animal.
In a way,
reaction, an
right.
automatic reaction.
Yes, that automatic process. And you also have this way in which, I mean, life force itself is being, you know, rethought as a kind of continuum between the mechanical and the organic, with the conversion of energy, right? It's all the same, you know, all the same energy. That's a very simplistic account of it, I know, okay? But nonetheless, I mean, in terms of the, literary and cultural imaginary, I think it's, you know, important to realize, you know, there are multiple accounts of these things. You know, we talk about the 19th century as a period in which the organic and the mechanical in some ways diverged. But there are also a lot of different ways to think about them overlapping. And it's a language that also has all kinds of cultural values associated with it. You know, we talk about organic communities. We talk about things that are natural, right? You know, and then we talk about things that are, you know, cold and mechanical. And, you know, you have to really, step back and rethink that. And I think that looking back on history helps us do that.
I would think that the two most conspicuous aspects of machines in the 19th century. I mean, yes, we had factories, but a lot of people, especially people who would write, didn't work in factories,
yeah.
At least not mechanized factories at this point. I realize Dickens did, but I think it was all handwork.
Really just like the blacking.
Yeah, right.
Blacking shoe polish.
But such people would have plenty of experience with steamships and locomotives.
Absolutely. Thanks for mentioning that. In fact, yes. And they did go to factories very often as a kind of Disneyland. I mean, the factory tours were really popular. Okay, so there was – but you're right that, a lot of the people who were reading these books and writing these books otherwise were not engaged with the industrial world in that sense. It was, a site of fantasy, and anxiety for them.
It's also a site for Dickens of tremendous class difference. In other words, the workers at these factories in Coketown are working long hours in miserable conditions and are being referred to as the hands, whereas, Mr. Bounderby, the factory owner, can live in splendor and luxury and, think that the factories are great. So can you talk about class and the machine?
Yeah, it's a very fraught issue, really complicated. And I think that there are ways in which the machine, especially the industrial machine, the factory machine, becomes a way to discipline workers and act out the authority of the middle, managerial class over other workers. And after all, this is a period where you have, an increasing kind of division of intellectual and manual labor. And so the steam engine itself, I talk about this in the first chapter of my book, is regarded as, it's called this, the controller general of various, and I quote, mechanical and organic members. So the human workers are imagined as these, parts of this greater kind of machine that's being controlled by this kind of central mechanism. I mean, it's a way to really kind of use bodily imagery, it's all viewed as this one corporeal entity in order to discipline and work out, class differences and class problems. Sometimes, though, the machine is also imagined itself as a resistant, worker, right? And in some ways, this gets back to the, rebellious elephant imagery that we were talking about earlier, too. So it's again, really complex, really textured, I think really interesting.
But the feeling in Victorian times, whether it's Dickens or somebody else, is that these machines have their benefits and they, in some cases, even have individuality.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we do overlook when we talk about, the monotonous engines of Dickens, for instance, this sense that the machine, that machines can in some ways be read or viewed like people, or that people can in some ways be read or viewed like machines, because, what you're looking at is a series of kind of, repeated actions or intensities. I mean, this is also something that comes up in, animal studies as well as, studies of intelligence, nowadays, all of these interpretive questions about, how do we view these various actions and, think about, individuality and consciousness as an intention. And if you look at a novel like Elizabeth Gaskell's Mary Barton, when she is characterizing her different, working class figures, she sometimes will do this, with her characters, especially when they're having moments of great, emotional turmoil. They'll actually start to act, very, mechanically, whether in grief or shock.
So the people can act mechanically, but the machines, on the other hand, can also act individualistically.
Yeah.
Like one locomotive might be different from the next somehow.
Right, yeah. Right.
Can you share that passage that you include in your book from Dickens? Because that was a new one for me.
Right. Here we go. Yes. And this is from Dickens's journal that he edited, Household Words, published in 1850, The Individuality of Locomotives. And so Dickens is writing about the distinct character, as Maureen was mentioning, of every locomotive engine running on a railway. It is perfectly well known to experienced practical engineers that if a dozen different locomotive engines were made at the same time, of the same power, for the same purpose, of like materials, in the same factory, each of those locomotive engines would come out with its own peculiar whims and ways, only ascertainable by experience. One engine will take a great meal of coke and water at once. Another will not hear of such a thing, but will insist on being coaxed by spades full and buckets full. One is disposed to start off when required at the top of his speed. Another must have little time to warm at his work and to get well into it. These peculiarities are so accurately mastered by skillful drivers that only particular men can persuade particular engines to do their best. It would seem as if some of these excellent monsters declared on being brought out of the stable, "If it's Smith who is to drive me, I won't go. If it's my friend Stokes, I am agreeable to anything." The railway company who should consign all their locomotives to one uniform standard of treatment without any allowance for varying shades of character and opinion would soon fall as much behindhand in the world as those greater governments are and ever will be who pursue the same course with the finer piece of work called man.
It's fascinating how Dickens personifies locomotives. He does end by saying the finer piece of work, which is man, though.
Yes.
So he doesn't say that machines are at the same level.
Right, right. I mean, we're not quite at the point maybe now or, I don't know, in a few decades where you have, various artificial sort of intelligence, challenges going on. But nonetheless, I think it's really striking that here he's talking about a continuum between the mechanical and the human, and he's actually asserting that there's, something very human about machines, that, there's a way in which, we can very much, identify with machinery, that they are our creatures. Right?
Well, he points out that these locomotives are made by people, and that accounts for the difference for the personality. So it is an extension, in a way, of the personality of the human that gets into the machine.
Oh, absolutely. That, they are us. They are we. Right?
More on machines in Victorian literature and culture when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
A new danger was being carried toward them by the river. Some wooden machinery had just given way on one of the wharfs, and huge fragments were being floated along. The sun was rising now, and the wide area of watery desolation was spread out in dreadful clearness around them. In dreadful clearness floated onward the hurrying, threatening masses. Tom, looking before him, saw death rushing on them, huge fragments clinging together in fatal fellowship, made one wide mass across the stream. "It is coming, Maggie," Tom said in a deep, hoarse voice, losing the oars and clasping her. In George Eliot's novel, The Mill on the Floss, we hear of the threat of industrialization going amok, and we are looking at industrialization and its imagery in Victorian literature and culture. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Tamara Katabjian. Well, we mentioned the steamships and we mentioned the locomotives, Tamara, but the mill would seem one of those places that you think of as being kind of pastoral and peaceful, and yet it is a factory of a kind, a machine.
Absolutely. And you know, this is a period where you have, especially in the earlier part of the 19th century, an interesting overlap between, you know, these seemingly very pastoral, I say seemingly, very pastoral, you know, water mills, you know, country mills, and, you know, factories increasingly powered by steam, often, you know, all kinds of, you know, hybrids going on. And, you know, Eliot's The Mill on the Floss is not usually a novel that we talk about that much when we discuss industrialism, because after all, it is set in the country and the mill is a water mill and it's all, you know, very organic and pastoral. And like a lot of Eliot is viewed as upholding these, you know, organic humanist communities, not what we would associate with industrial machinery, at least not right off the bat. But if you look at that flood scene that, you know, Norman, you were reading just now, you gain an incredible sense of force, of power. And it's really, it's water power, right? It's the river that is flooding.
It's unstoppable.
It is unstoppable. It's this, you know, incredible, you know, natural disaster. But if you read the book, you know, starting from the beginning, you learn about this town, you know, St. Ogg's, and this family, the Tullivers, you know, the brother and the sister, Maggie Tulliver and Tom Tulliver, who are in the passage. You learn about what Eliot calls the incredible, she calls it oppressive narrowness of their life. And she talks about this in terms of containment, in terms of pressure, in terms of, you know, actually, you know, getting a sense of literally and figuratively confinement, much like the confinement, you know, in a steam boiler. And Eliot was, you know, incredibly familiar actually with these processes, as were actually many, many Victorians, right? I mean, this was machinery that was much more comprehensible to them than, you know, many of our, you know, the technologies today. So you really have an entire social and natural landscape that's set up in terms of hydraulic industrial pressure building. You know, Maggie herself is imagined as this kind of organic, mechanical amalgam. She's described as, you know, a plant seed that is, you know, ready to explode. And again, I mean, actually, this is much like the melancholy mad elephants and, you know, some of these other figures that we looked at. She's not actually exploding, or at least, you know, not very much, you know, in the novel. But you always get that sense of threat, you know, somehow, that this is going to happen.
She's about to blow her top.
That's right. Well, she's compared to a volcano, fire. Yeah.
Part of it seems with Maggie to be that she's a girl who's being restricted by that.
Yes.
And she's in this provincial society that doesn't see an escape, where she doesn't see an escape for herself.
Right. It is very gendered. It does have to do with, you know, particularly her limitations and the lack of, you know, sort of vocation that she sees for herself, and just her, you know, incredibly kind of imaginative personality in this, you know, provincial environment. I mean, here Eliot is being very, you know, in some ways autobiographical, actually. But to get to the flood, anyhow, I mean, it's almost as if in this novel you have a steam boiler, kind of a steam engine, you know, turned inside out. You know, people have called the steam engine, you know, a natural force machine. And she's imagining the environment this way, much like, you know, her contemporaries and people that she read, you know, scientists like, you know, Hermann von Helmholtz, who George Eliot's partner, George Henry Lewes, read, the scientist who came up with, or at least was one of the scientists who came up with, you know, theories of thermodynamics, this sense that, you know, nature is, the natural world is part of, you know, an ongoing cycle of energy conversion and conservation. And so this is all of a piece with her novel, right?
What about the process of mesmerism? You get into that in your book in a bit, and that was something that the 19th century folks were very fascinated with.
Yes, this was huge.
Frightened up.
Right. And so mesmerism was this incredible spiritualist trend. I mean, I call it incredible because I'm just so fascinated by it. This belief that individuals shared amongst themselves a kind of universal, invisible, imponderable sort of fluid. It was much like very early sort of theories of energy, in fact. Well, they didn't even call it energy then, you know, power, force. And that also this fluid would convey influences. So, I mean, you can think of this also in terms of early group psychology, right? You know, different kinds of networks. And the language of mesmerism, of this kind of spiritual influence, is a remarkably industrial and mechanical language of coordination, regulation, networks, energy. I mean, if you put it side by side with the language of various, you know, writers on the factory, like, you know, Marx and like, you know, this other fellow, Andrew Ure, who, you know, Marx has in some ways, you know, made his career by criticizing, it's just so striking, this sense, these concerns that are raised about influence, coordination, discipline, individuality, agency, will, the overall kind of penetrability of the human body and humanness more generally, this sense that, you know, maybe when we're talking about people, we shouldn't simply be talking about individual selves, but about communities, about collectives. You know, where you know, what is humanness?
And
right?
So mesmerism, which is related to or can be related to hypnotism, has a relationship in which somehow the collective is seen as overriding the will of the individual.
Well, certainly influencing that individual. I mean, that individual in turn could also, I think, you know, exert some influence. But there are various manuals, which actually I look at, which talk about, you know, how this should be done properly, you know, much like, you know, industrial manuals in a way, you know, that the mesmerist should, you know, exert a particular kind of influence and power and coordination. And by the way, I mean, the same language also plays into the popular discourse surrounding music, actually, and the influence of, you know, musicians and, you know, virtuosi and so on. Franz Liszt, mm-hmm. right, and his, you know
well,
dynamic.
He had quite the influence over women. I know that.
Right.
I think he had a faint when he came into the room.
Yeah. So are you saying then with a mesmerist that it's turning the subject into kind of a machine that can be controlled, turning that person into almost like a robot?
In some ways. I mean, well, that was seen both as a utopian possibility and as an anxiety because, I mean, it could be a good thing to be that robot if you're, you know, incredibly sort of self-regulated and if someone's influence is, you know, good on you, right? But of course, you know, that also could be really horrible in terms of, you know, manipulation, and there were lots of, you know, kind of political anxieties about this. So it went both ways. Harriet Martineau, who wrote really prolifically on, you know, all kinds of things, she was a very popular, you know, kind of journalist, polymath. You know, she wrote her letters on mesmerism, and there was a lot of controversy actually about her relationship with, you know, her mesmerist. But she, you know, sought the therapy because of a really, you know, painful kind of uterine tumor, actually. And I mean, it aided her, as she writes, you know, a great deal. So, you know, you have people pursuing this for different reasons and seeing its mechanical effects in some ways as being, you know, very, very therapeutic, you know, very, very helpful, you know, and then sometimes not.
Now, how does the role of the emotion come in the whole thing in terms of distinguishing between people and machines?
Yeah.
I mean, if we're blurring the line here with something like mesmerism, which can arguably turn the human into a kind of a device, a machine, what would be cited as then a fundamental difference, if any, between human and machine?
That is a very good question. And the networks are seen as, you know, analogous in many ways, as, you know, communication, you know, feedback networks. I mean, precursors in some ways also to, you know, today's, you know, wireless, actually.
You know, I really start to have a lot of sympathy for the Victorians because here they're just coming to terms with the Industrial Revolution and the difference between people and machines. Mm-hmm. And then they have Darwin coming along telling
Absolutely.
Them that there's no great difference between people and animals.
Yeah.
You know,
no
it's
wonder
like a big
a lot
second
of
wave.
Right. And I mean, they are all interrelated, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about, you know, earlier times, sometimes, like in the 18th century, they would envision God as a kind of great watchmaker with
right.
the world functioning like a well-oiled machine. How did some of the new thinking about machines influence conceptions of the creator?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question. I don't actually cover that in my book, but I am really intrigued by this because, you know, increasingly in the 19th century, what you're really talking about is a motor. And Anson Robbenbach, in his book The Human Motor, you know, does a wonderful job of like highlighting the differences between this motor and what, you know, he terms, you know, sort of the machine before that. But the crucial difference here is energy and power and ways in which that fits in, especially post-1850s, you know, theories about thermodynamics. But you have lots of different models of mechanism and organicism that are kind of overlapping in different ways. I mean, you also have, you know, various writers. I mean, you know, the Romantics are famous for this, saying, well, you know, organic life is a very different thing from the mechanical, right? But they are talking about the watch. I mean, they are talking about the kind of, you know, Hobbesian clock there, and indeed that kind of, you know, God as watchmaker. I mean, I see how in that whole tradition of natural theology, where, you know, you have like William Paley, for instance, writing about God as a watchmaker and, you know, natural phenomena that you encounter as being like watches, you know, that show a certain kind of craft, right? And thus, you know, kind of intelligent design, right? Mm-hmm. Evidence of the creator. You see how that certainly continues to shape the arguments of theologians throughout the 19th century, but they really have to grapple with this question of energy and power and you know, disorder too, entropy. Like, you know, where do these things go?
Well, I was going
you know,
to say, there's
closed systems.
This big question about perpetual motion too,
right.
at that time, and trying to figure out, you know, could you create something that would of its own power
right.
continue to run indefinitely.
Yes, and here we're sounding like steampunk fantasy, definitely.
Well, we'll get into that a little bit
yes.
later. I do have a question, though, about if machines are such a big part of, you know, Victorian literature and culture, is there any sense of responsibility? Who is responsible for running these machines?
Right. Yeah, and it's fraught. and some of it has to do with, you know, who owns them, right? Or as Marx famously said, you know, fixed capital, you know. But also this question of expertise, because after all, when you look at the history of industrialism, it's continually a history really of de-skilling. I mean, labor is, it's becomes specialized, it becomes de-skilled. In many cases, it becomes, you know, literally feminized in the sense that employers want to, you know, put to work women. And you know, before regulations were in place, you know, children so that they can pay them less.
And they're more compliant.
They're viewed as, yes, more docile and obedient and so on. And so it's intriguing in that way, too, because also if you read some of the accounts like of this, you know, Andrew Ure, who wrote this Philosophy of Manufacturers, for instance, this kind of, you know, industrialist manual in a way, he talks about how many of the innovations were mechanical innovations were adapted when strikes were occurring, or, you know, when there was labor trouble, in order to deal with these kinds of problems and issues. You know, so you can see how then literature picks up on this by, on the one hand, like we said before, representing the machine as being, you know, like a worker, but on the other hand, the worker's competitor, you know, that which will replace the worker and literally in some ways, you know, kind of replace or graft onto the worker's body in a relationship where the machine is described as being, you know, like an additional arm or like a leg. I mean, actually, like a, you know, prosthesis, that is like an addition or a supplement to the body.
You even have a section of your book talking about disabled workers and how a machine could give them a way of having a kind of arm or some kind of functioning that they didn't actually already have. So it's a different way of looking at the machine as adding to rather than taking away.
Absolutely.
We're going to have some final thoughts on machines in Victorian culture when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Stephen bent over his loom, quiet, watchful, and steady, a special contrast, as every man was in the forest of looms where Stephen worked, to the crashing, smashing, tearing piece of mechanism at which he labored. Never fear, good people of an anxious turn of mind, that art will consign nature to oblivion. Set anywhere, side by side, the work of God and the work of man, and the former, even though it be a troop of hands of very small account, will gain in dignity from the comparison. That's a passage from Charles Dickens' Hard Times about the contrast between machines and people. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Tamara Katabjian, and her book is called The Lives of Machines, The Industrial Imaginary in Victorian Literature and Culture. Strikes me that it's a little bit ironic that Charles Dickens is decrying machines while I'm sure he was wearing clothes that were woven on a loom, and he's writing in railways, and it's a little bit like contemporaries now who will kind of speak out against the internet in a blog.
Right, right. It's absolutely the case. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and Dickens had a very ambivalent relationship to technology. I mean, and it also just depends where you look, I think, you know, for Dickens and for, you know, any number of writers in this period. And this is why I think it's so important to look to both literal and, you know, more, you know, metaphoric mentions of machines. The fact that, you know, we are, you know, in the same passage that we hear about how there's so much mystery about, you know, Stephen and not about the machines. You also have machines that assume a lot of really different guises. You have machines that are, you know, monotonous, that are predictable, but that are also crashing and smashing. You know, you have Stephen himself being described as a mystery. How? By being incredibly steady, a steady, regular worker that people, in fact, are suspicious of because he's so steady. So I think that there are many different ways to look at this once again.
What about this term steampunk? Tell us what that is and how the use of it is related in any way to the kinds of things that came before it.
Well, I was really excited about this development, which happened, or at least I was aware of it happening once I was done writing this book. But steampunk then is a development in literature, in art, in, you know, do-it-yourself like crafting and graphic
fashion.
Fiction. Yes, oh, definitely fashion, you know, conventions. That marries steam, anachronistic technology, you know, Victorian technology, dirty technology, with punk, with a kind of, you know, anarchic, rebellious sort of attitude. And, I mean, I can't even pretend to, you know, give you a sense of the, you know, multifarious forms of this, but I was so excited about steampunk, you know, in light of my book, because I think in some ways it is addressing some very similar questions and issues, namely that, you know, there was this other side to the Victorian period that took great pleasure in machine skill, that embraced, you know, for all of its problems, the kind of grit and ruin and, you know, mess and, you know, yes, you know, oppressiveness, it's really questionable, of industrialism.
So how does it look visually, steampunk?
Oh, that's, I mean, I think there are many, many different forms to the movement. I mean, I'm actually teaching a course at Beloit right now on steampunk. So,
I mean, you know, it seems to have a touch of the gothic.
Yes, gothic, you know, clockwork is part of it, which in some ways I think it, you know, doesn't quite, to me, is not quite historically, you know, accurate, mm-hmm. but nonetheless.
I mean, I think of something like Edward Scissorhands, where, you know, you have this person who's part mechanic, part organic, and then he comes out of a factory run by Vincent Price and is kind of left to his own devices when Vincent Price's character dies. And but the look, too, if I remember right, is of this very kind of run-down Victorian. I mean, there's something kind of blasted about it all, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, like a kind of brass and wood sort of, you know, dirty cyborg, something like
right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like The City of Lost Children, you know, maybe is a film that you might consider as part of that aesthetic. I mean, there are any number of novels out there now.
Going back earlier, Metropolis, of course. That factory with things sort of askew.
Right.
Things are not entirely on center, not quite right.
Yeah. So steampunk, I think it's important to recognize then it's certainly – we certainly shouldn't take it as a literal or historical account of the Victorian period. I think rather what we should – what's really exciting about it is that it's a, you know, technophilic notion of this period, that it's giving you an alternate look. I mean, it's certainly a look that has all kinds of really eccentric and exciting programs and projects attached to it. But it is, I think, in some ways allied to what I'm hoping to do with this book, because, you know, I want us to carefully consider, you know, technophilia, to carefully consider how we identify with machines, you know, how that actually was a crucial part of the Victorian period, and how especially the language surrounding literature and high art, you know, has sort of strayed from that. I think in part we do this to emphasize our difference from the Victorians,
right,
our distance from them. But, you know, I would also stress in many ways, you know, we are still living in that industrial world. I mean, for good or for ill, we've, you know, benefited tremendously from these new powers, but we're also, I think, very much suffering from these dilemmas. And we think about ourselves, you know, our deepest human feelings and attachments and communities in, you know, a similarly sort of mechanical way. We don't necessarily want to think that. Nothing might in some ways seem more alien from us than machines. But there's a way in which when we talk about, you know, letting off steam, you know, we are really thinking of ourselves as steam engines.
Or if we play the piano, we are in effect, you kind of argue in your book, the machine and the piano. I mean, we think of the piano as very bringing out our soul, bringing out something artistic, but it is in its own way a kind of machine.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was outfitted with lots and lots of steel and, you know, the big, thick strings and lots more tension to highlight difference between, you know, piano and forte, to make it piano forte. You know, all those things were indebted to, you know, mechanical processes, in fact. And so, yes, those depths of, you know, the musical soul themselves are part of these, you know, mechanical, technical processes.
And yet, Dickens would say that pianos, like locomotives, each varies, each has a personality of its own, and then that in turn would magnify the personality of the player.
Right, right. Beautifully put.
Wow, fascinating hour that we have spent moving like a locomotive through this imagery of machines and the industrial in Victorian literature and culture. And our guest has been Tamara Katabjian. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. In addition to literature, there was, of course, as we heard at the beginning of the hour, a musical manifestation of this fascination with machines in the 19th century, and this is one of the most famous. It's the Perpetuum Mobile, a perpetual motion waltz by Johann Strauss the Younger, played by the Cincinnati Pops, Eric Kunzel conducting. Thank you.